Welcome to this special edition of Life Between the Vines, Working in the Cellar at GoldenEye, Part 2. During the week of October 2nd, I spent 4 days working crush at GoldenEye Winery in Anderson Valley, the home of GoldenEye and Migration Wines, which are part of the Duckhorn wine family. By visiting the Life Between the Vines website, you'll be able to check out 3 videos shot during this time. One shows the night harvest, and that's where you really get to see how efficient and fast the pickers are. Another video is a look into the crush itself, and the third is a salute to the GoldenEye crew. Here's where you can see the face behind the label. You can also find these videos and additional pictures on our Facebook page, as well as YouTube. In this program, I interviewed just about all the crew behind the scenes at the winery. I'd like to think that this gives a better perspective on not only how the wine is made, but just who is making it. All right, we're going to be talking to Nate Miller again here. We're out in the car, or I should say we're out in the pickup truck. We're out looking at some of the vineyards. But one thing Nate started talking about was education and farming and you know, some of what's going on in our country in terms of the fact that a lot of people don't understand farming and there's, again, not a lot of public education. So can you kind of take it from there, Nate?
Yeah, one of the things today is, you know, we have a population that's about 1% that live an agrarian lifestyle, that they know where their food comes from, and the other 99% of the population and major majority of the voters just don't know where their food comes from. It doesn't come from Safeway. It doesn't come from Vons or the different grocery stores. It actually gets produced by these people that live this ag lifestyle. And as our country has developed over time, people are getting farther and farther away from that, and they really need to know where their food comes from. And I believe in the Ag in the Classroom programs. Everybody knows Mike Rowe with Dirty Jobs. Mike Rowe is a huge proponent for brown, which is the soil and the dirt in which we produce all of this fruit and our food from, whether it be meat, fruits, vegetables, nuts. California here is a huge, huge ag state, and we feed a lot of the world here, along with a lot of other states. The Wisconsin dairy cheese, and it just amazes me that a lot of these people just don't know where their food comes from these days.
Now, are there programs that you know of that exist in schools where kids are getting this education? Is there, you know, the kind of a field trip thing where kids can go to a farm and sort of learn a little bit about what's going on, or even going to a vineyard?
Well, there is the 4-H program, which takes kids that are 9 through 18 years of age. You can do a project, whether it's raising an animal for a fair for sale, or the Future Farmers of America, which is the high school, basically grades 9 through 12. And there's a huge, huge movement of these kids. They teach them accounting. They teach them how to balance a checkbook. It teaches a lot of responsibility that is lost in today's kids and youth. I believe these kids that come out of these programs, they're able to manage their finances and not get themselves in trouble.
Is there anything for city kids that exists where they could have this opportunity to understand where their food is coming from?
Yeah, it's Ag in the Classroom. We're the Farm Bureau here in California is moving more towards this Ag in the Classroom program, trying to educate kids on where their food comes from, how it's produced. You know, Future Farmers of America, you don't have to have land to have a project. There are people out there that do have that land that are willing to let kids come out there and experience those projects. There are quite a few families that have had, that do have land, that have had their kids go through that program, that now they're elderly, and it's a great relationship. They get to pass on a lot of information to a younger generation out there, and that younger generation gets the opportunity to use that land.
you know, a lot of cities I've seen have urban areas that are that have been recovered, that they've turned them into sort of like mini farms where your average condo owner or maybe, you know, apartment dweller can lease this property and just grow their own tomatoes or squash or whatever. Are you familiar with anything like that?
Yeah, and I think that's a great thing to have, especially in the urban areas. It gives them more of a connection with how their food actually comes to them.
And emphasis on people who go to the restaurants that talk about eating local, buy local. That's such a big deal right now, but it's also a good idea to know what is the local? Who is the local? Who is that person bringing it to you?
Yeah, I mean, you go to farmers markets sometimes, and you've got guys that come from over 150 to 200 miles to attend that farmers market, but you may not know that.
Right.
So you got to really look to see who your real local guys are.
And thus you know exactly where the food is coming from and what kind of care has been put into it, just like wine.
Exactly. You know, we put a lot of effort into everything that we do, and it's blood, sweat, and tears to get it out there, but the reward is seeing the enjoyment that people get through drinking that bottle of wine and a lot of the rhetoric that's going back and forth on different blogs and our Facebook and Twitter pages. That is their payment to us, is seeing that enjoyment.
Driving through the vineyard, you took me to a lot of inherent dangers in working in these properties because of the slopes and all that goes into it. I mean, we were talking about the clippers before. This is not an easy kind of gig. So appreciating what goes into it really does make a difference when you enjoy it, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, you know, it's a satisfaction and a pride that comes with this job, that working hard and coming home dog tired and dirty at the end of the day, there is a satisfaction and a sense of pride that goes into it that a lot of Americans used to have that has somewhat been lost, I think, in today's society. You've got, you see all those old black and white photos of the guys up on the beams building the Empire State Building and even something more local for us, the Golden Gate Bridge. Those guys had pride in what they did, and it's not a bad thing to come home at the end of the day dog tired and dirty.
I got my work boots on. They're dirty. One other thing I want to mention before we finish up on this, and I just want to go back to Mike Rowe for a minute. And again, a lot of people familiar with him as being a voiceover as well as his work on Dirty Jobs. Do you know the name of his website by chance?
The website for Mike Rowe's website is Mike Rowe Works. And I got to get a shout out to him. Go Brown.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it, Nate.
Thank you.
All right, I am here with Lisa Perez, and she is the lab intern here at GoldenEye. How are you doing, Lisa?
I'm good. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good. So, tell me a little bit about what it is to be a lab intern. I see you've got a sheet of paper with all kinds of numbers on it, and you've got some samples here.
Yeah, I have to go around, and I am taking the sugar and temperature level. We want the sugar level to be negative. And temperatures not to be too high.
Now, is this something you're planning on continuing on in the lab end of the wine business? Is this something you have an interest in, or you enjoy what you're doing? Or
I enjoy what I'm doing. I would have never imagined I would be doing this. My goal was to be a pediatrician.
It's a little different. You're babysitting grapes instead of working with kids.
Yeah, I am. But yeah, it'd be a great career for me.
So obviously you've got somewhat of an interest in science then.
Yeah, I do.
So do you think you'd go down the trail of being an oenologist, or is the idea of winemaking more interesting?
I think the winemaking is more interesting for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And are you a wine drinker?
No.
Really?
I can't yet. I'm not 21.
Oh, okay. So how long have you been here at GoldenEye?
This is actually my first year during the harvest. I worked some bottling, but yeah, this is my first year.
And Jose Luis is your husband as well. So somewhat of a family effort because your mom works over at the tasting room, and you're here, and your husband Jose Luis is working in the cellar, as well as Pancho.
Yes, they are.
So are you from California originally?
Yes, I was born here in Ukiah.
You were born in Ukiah. I mean, you're really, you're kind of far away from things up here, aren't you?
Yeah, I am.
Do you ever get down to San Francisco at all, or is the city not interesting to you?
No, I love the city. I lived in Sacramento for a year, over a year.
But you came back this way.
Yeah, because of José Luis.
Do you still live in Ukiah now or at this point, or do you live here in around Boonville or Philo?
We live in Boonville. Yeah.
Well, great. Well, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you.
Well, once again, we're on the road, and we're back with Neil Bernardi of GoldenEye and Migration, but I'd say specifically Migration, winemaker at Migration. And we're tooling around, I guess I'd say, the outskirts of Healdsburg and Sonoma, but I don't know exactly where you're at. Why don't you tell me where we are?
So we are on River Road right now, and we're heading east, and we're kind of in the, well, we're in the middle of the Russian River area. To our south is the Green Valley area. We've been kind of touring around looking at some vineyards that we worked with earlier today, and it's one of the cooler areas of the Russian River. And then to our north is the Russian River, kind of the river, I guess, into it, for lack of a better word, the river. And then to the north of that is Healdsburg and Alexander Valley and Dry Creek, and then, of course, Mendocino above that, so...
As we drive, looking at some kind of dubious skies, we've had rain for the last couple of days, which is very unusual for this time of year, and we've had a beautiful afternoon so far, so maybe we'll luck out. We're going to come back to that in a minute. I want to give you a question here that occurred to me. This area, you'd said, there's a tremendous amount of apple growing, a lot of orchards through here, very popular area for growing apples, and you'd kind of made a comment about an area you thought, gee, that'd be kind of great. I'd love to plant that area with vineyard. Now, a lot of us are familiar with the idea of crop rotation and obviously overuse of soils in corn farming and alfalfa and that kind of thing. Is there any effect from that? We talk about old vines. Does anything come from, you know, the continual use of vines in the soil?
Well, I think vines fall in the same camp as orchards do. I mean, they're very long-lived plants. They end up being very small, kind of bonsai trees, you know, for lack of a better word. But
they almost bear resemblance to that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we shape them the way that we do for our purposes. But I think their natural way of growth would be to climb up trees and to be kind of part of a more complex ecosystem, certainly than we've put them in. But in terms of the depletion of the soil with grapevines, we do a lot, and certainly a lot of growers, there's a lot of different techniques that one can use to kind of reinvigorate the soil, whether it's using compost or conventional fertilizers or, organic material, putting it into the soil. One definitely has to kind of farm your soil as well as farming your vines. I mean, I think many people would say that you're ultimately always going to be farming the soil because that's where the nutrients and life come from for your vines. So yes, you definitely have to think about the overall nutrient status of your vineyards and replenish it on a cyclical basis.
You had also said that some of the apples, the droppings, the apples that fall from the trees is good for the soil for the grapes. I'm thinking of when you have sort of the flavor, you get apple in a Chardonnay, that kind of a thing. Does that apple have an influence in that way, or is it strictly more of a nutrient type thing, feeding the soil?
Well, we were talking before about how a lot of this area was grapes planted in the Russian River area before Prohibition, and then once Prohibition came along, it was all basically wiped clean because the industry was no longer viable, or at least in the legal sense. After that, many acres were planted to apples and prunes and pears and other walnuts, you mentioned, other agricultural products that made more sense. Since that time, or early 20th century, it's been a kind of a slow and probably an ever-increasing replanting towards grapes as this area has become recognized as a really high-quality area. And so we were talking before about how a lot of the vineyards that we're working with are in areas that at one point were apple orchards. And I think that that time as apple orchards, whether between the leaf litter and also the kind of the apple fall, has added a lot of good organic material to the already kind of sandy, loamy Sebastopol sandy loam soils. So yes, I think they were a major contributor to kind of the soil structure and profile over, you know, in this particular area.
So it's been a good thing, is kind of what we're saying here.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, and to answer your question directly, like, that was kind of a long-winded response, but I don't think, in my personal experience, I don't think that the apples have a direct kind of flavor impact, but they definitely have done quite a bit for the soil and therefore kind of the nutrient and growth status of the different vineyards.
A moment ago, I mentioned the weather last night, which would have been October 4th, I believe. Got a lot of rain. Now, I was staying up in the Anderson Valley area, so about an hour and a half away. You know, you got a lot of rain down here as well. And you still have Pinot on the vine, and you still have Chard on the vine. Where's your head at this point?
I'm concerned, certainly. I'm glad in one sense that most of the Pinot was ready to be picked earlier before the rain, so that's a good thing, a very good thing. But we've got a good amount of Chardonnay out there, and some of my absolute best and favorite vineyards are out there. So it's definitely going to be a challenge. I mean, it's been a cold year, a cool year. So we were talking yesterday about this is kind of the, you know, the challenge and the promise of working in really cool climate Appalachians, because you know, in some years it's the absolute perfect conditions and you stand a chance of making really incredibly high quality delicious wines, and then other years, because you know the climate is very, you know, it's notably cool, you run the risk of running into adverse weather later in the season. And so, you know, this is kind of this is the challenge that we have to deal with in these climates. But I think it's well worth the potential for incredible quality every other year. But no, but I have high hopes that we are going to be able to make incredible wines this year. In fact, I think they're going to be awesome wines. It's just it's going to take a lot of extra thought leading up to when we actually pick the grapes. It's going to take a lot of thought as to how we, you know, whether we drop fruit or we do a double sorting or what kind of steps we take to make sure that the stuff that gets in the fermenter or in the press is just the absolute best quality fruit it could possibly be. Because as everybody knows, and it's kind of a tried and true statement in the wine business, it's all about your starting material.
That's what's going on in the vine.
That's it. It's nice from one perspective, we're on the vine so late because it means that these grapes that are out there have had the opportunity to mature. Their flavors, their acid profile is really coming into balance with the sugars. So it'll be, you know, potentially one of these high quality, incredible years where you have really reasonable, you know, sugars, which won't lead to excessive alcohols, and you'll have well-developed flavors, well-developed seed maturity, and, you know, it can all come together and really be beautiful.
Working for Migration, you have a unique situation because you have a number of wine labels under this roof. You have Duckhorn, of course, and you have Bill Nancaro. You have David Marchese over at Paradox, and of course you have Zach Rasmussen, and then yourself. Do you guys get the chance to round table each of your I know you probably can't do every single wine, but do you bounce things off each other? I mean, especially because Duckhorn and Paradox are so completely different than the direction you guys are going with Chardonnay and Pinot with Migration and Goldeneye.
You know, that's it's one of the really wonderful things about working for a company like this is that we sit down on a monthly basis, probably actually every couple of weeks we get together and talk about what we're doing individually and together and how we can share you know, help each other out in what we're doing. But it's incredible to get somebody's opinion. You know, these are all incredible professional winemakers who are very, very passionate about what they do and love the wines they're making and are always seeking to do things better. And so it's great. We get together and it's, you know, it's the gloves are off and we speak very frankly and earnestly about, you know, the wines are in front of us. We present wines for discussion. We talk about strategy and different winemaking techniques. And it's an incredible kind of kettle for creativity, you know, and so we have the opportunity to really share ideas and help each other grow, really. So I found it incredibly helpful from a personal perspective, and I think helpful for Migration, the brand, to benefit from, you know, wisdom and pointers from other kind of parts of the wine industry in terms of varietals and styles, and to be able to take those and kind of learn from them. It's been great.
And it's a great way to grow on top of that. And from my experience working with the guys at Migration and Goldeneye up at the winery, you have a great crew and good influences between you and Zach, I have to say.
Well, yeah, I mean, I thank you for that, and I feel incredibly blessed to be working with the people I work with, especially, no, everybody in general, but, you know, Zach is a important mentor of mine. I mean, I was his assistant winemaker from 2004 to 2000 and early 2007. So he's taught me so much, and I feel really fortunate to work with him specifically.
I don't know if we're going to get a chance to catch up with you again into the audio world, but I just want to say thanks for everything, and thanks for giving us some time here and showing me the vineyards.
Thank you, Ray. It was a pleasure to see you again.
Is that Remy?
Remy, yeah.
Yeah, I met him the other day. We've been talking about him a lot because of the name.
Yeah, right, Remy Martin.
So I guess I'm saving the best for last here. I'm here with Zach Rasmussen, winemaker at Goldeneye, and this is my opportunity to spend a couple minutes with you to, number one, say thank you very much for this opportunity, but two, to say you do have a really incredible organization with some really great people. How have you pulled these people together? Did they come to you? Are they drawn to this company? What happens?
Well, you know, you're lucky to come at the time of harvest where we collect, you know, a bunch of misfit toys, as we call them, from all walks of life who have a budding or a nascent interest in wine, who have come to us with an interest in determining for themselves whether wine production is something that they are is right for them. They either love or have found wine either on the restaurant side or just the pure straight drinking side, as some of our college kids would tell you. But it's a chance for them to come and to do something honest. I always try to compel people to find their own personal excellence this time of year, because it can be long hours, it can be hectic, and it's a time really to dig deep and try to figure out who you are just for a short period of time. So, but we've enjoyed your contribution as well, so thank you.
I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun climbing around and doing what I've been able to do. And interesting, too, when you meet people like Casey, who I didn't realize was brand new to the biz, and then, of course, you got people like Darren who've been around a little bit longer, and it's interesting to see how far these guys are going to go. Will they make it to be winemaker, or are they going to go into the vineyards only, or what's going to happen with them?
No, it's fun, too, because, you know, I've been doing this for 18 years now, and probably have 50 or 60 of these interns, you know, in my sort of closet, and only a few of them have remained in the wine production side, and that's okay for me, because if nothing else, I came to this business without a formal degree. I was sort of testing my own spirit in my first harvest, and so it's right for some people and it's not for others, but it's certainly an experience that no one will forget.
Speaking of which, what got you into it? I mean, did you have a passion for wine or what?
I did. You know, I was lucky enough as a college student to have two things. One, a professor who invited me to his wine study group, which was funded by, you know, professors. I was the, you know, lonely student in the room who...
Wait a minute, a wine study group that was funded?
Well, not,
wow.
Not funded, although, as you know, I certainly wasn't buying the wine, yeah, that I was able to drink. I don't even, so that was the first thing. It got my interest in realizing that wines were different from place, and I started understanding that place was important. I also had a work study job where I was a bartender for the president of the college that I worked for, so I was... I was able to meet Warren Winiarski, who sat on the board of the school.
Wow.
Who was ultimately the guy who offered me my first harvest position.
Oh, I didn't know that. Was that over at Stagsleep?
It was, yeah. So I started in 95 working for Warren, and I stayed there for 3.5 years.
Wow, that kind of gives you quite a pedigree, doesn't it?
Well, you know, it's been fun. I quickly thereafter found Pinot Noir, my love for Pinot Noir, and worked for Robert Sinsky Vineyards and in the Napa Carneros as well. But ultimately, I was drawn to the Anderson Valley and, you know, and what I thought was the ultimate potential for growing and making Pinot Noir here.
And that kind of brings me to this whole idea of Anderson Valley, which, again, is a place I think people should really discover, because a little quieter, a lot easier to get around, at least in terms of getting to places without a lot of traffic. How did you find this place? I mean, was it just because of Pinot, or?
It was sort of a growing discontent for what I thought the wines of Carneros were, and it was just my evolution of understanding of Pinot Noir, tasting some wines here that I thought had great potential. And also, as you can see now, the drive-through on the way to the Mendocino Coast, it had a draw, you know. I mean, it's a beautiful sort of pastoral, untouched place, you know, and so I was able to convince my wife to give it a trial run, and we've been here 11 years now since, so, and happy to be there.
So to be big adjustment for your wife to come into a place like this where grocery shopping alone could be a challenge.
Well, the grocery store nearest store is 45 minutes away, right? Very rural. You know, and we often joke around saying this is a place where men want to live and their wives won't let them, right? And that's happened time and time again. But no, I'm lucky. My wife is, and I have two young children, and we've made a life of it here, and I think she's happier, you know, she's as content here as I am.
That's pretty cool. Yep. How old are your kids, by the way?
I have a 5-year-old and a 9-year-old, both girls.
All right. Girls, good. Good luck to you. One of the interesting things that I learned about is that you're working on a sparkling project, and I got to kind of touch that just a little bit myself. Tell me about it. What brought that on?
It was ultimately our love for sparkling wine and the fact that in our business, we're, you know, the wine business is very unique in the sense that it's truly agriculture, but it's also hospitality, right? And so we're on both sides of it. So we love sparkling wine. We love to pour sparkling wine. We're in one of the, arguably the best sparkling wine appellations in New America. And we have our estate vineyards. You know, Goldeneye is based upon the foundation of 4 estate vineyards. And we have a multitude of different clones, and so we're making a small offering. You know, we're going to try to bottle 200-300 cases this year, being our very first shot at it. And it's got us all super excited. You know, everybody is just, you know, the whole company is sort of bubbling with the news of this, right? So it's fun, and I'm learning a lot. It's a new challenge, puts a new sense of, you know, fear in you when you undertake a task that you've never done before. And as a great consumer of sparkling wine, I'm happy to have some in house.
I think it's pretty impressive that you're willing to take something like that on, considering that Goldeneye and Migration both have very strong reputations amongst people who drink Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. So you're kind of stepping off into very different territory.
No, and we've said from the beginning that we only want to do it if we can produce a sparkling wine of the same caliber as our Goldeneye and Migration wines or any of the Duckhorn wines, you know. So we have taken our very best clones, our very best part of the fields, cropped them at still wine levels. Part of the myth of sparkling wine is that you can crop a vine more heavily.
Okay, when you refer to crop, you're just talking about the growing?
Yeah, carry more fruit per vine or ultimately tons per acre.
So you're not dropping as much fruit for sparkling wine, is what you're saying, right?
We got into this with this idea that we would pick the perfect blocks for sparkling regardless of the actual, we had no plan of the blocks. We wanted to see the numbers and the flavors present themselves to us. So yeah, this is the same grapes that would have gone into Goldeneye and or Migration.
Okay, so it's kind of up in the air as whether you're going to put a vintage on it or not. It may, exactly. May go without that.
Yeah, it's all open right now. And the nice part about sparkling is you have a lot of time on your side. So, you know, we've just finished the base wines. That's what you were doing today. It's topping up the base wines, and they'll sit in barrel for a year before we even think about doing the tirage bottling.
I think it's great you're going after something like that. And obviously, you have neighbors doing the same thing, so it'll be interesting to see how it turns out.
No, exactly. And I'm spending all my money there, so that's part of the problem.
Great. One last thing I want to talk about is just a little statistical type thing for Goldeneye. What is your output?
We make about 15,000 cases of Goldeneye Pinot Noir in all of its different, you know, manifestations, that being the Anderson Valley label, which is most broadly distributed. And then we make 5 different single vineyard and, you know, sort of fun wines, whether they be our Vingris, which is a rosé style, or some winery direct, you know, club type of wine. So it's about 15,000 cases.
Yeah, I heard about your Gewurz. That was pretty cool. In fact, I got to see the grapes when I was with Nate.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that was, we've grown Gewurz for many years, just a small half an acre, and we've always made it for the employees, and we all love it so much that last year it was so good, and I don't blame anybody or give anyone credit for that. It just presented itself that we decided to bottle it for the very first time. And again, because it was of the caliber of what we expect of wine for ourselves. So hopefully we'll do it again.
Well, and that kind of also makes a point when you talk about making it for your employees that from my point of view, I'm really impressed with the way you treat your people here. They really are well taken care of, you know, especially during harvest when they're stuck here. They do have a strong dedication to you. You seem to have a very relaxed style, but you seem to also, as a winemaker, know exactly what you want to do.
Yeah, and then that is true. And that's, I mean, I tend to be a control freak and try to cloak that, you know, in terms of a relaxed. But, you know, you've seen the way we make wine. We have innumerable small lot fermentations all going on at the same time. So what I try to do is present a situation where people know what they need to be doing at any given time and also have fun. If you're not having fun at harvest, you know, then you shouldn't be here, you know, and because as you've seen, we'll work 12, 14 hour days, 7 days a week when it really gets thick. So as I always tell people, I spend more time with you than my family. So let's have some family atmosphere while we're here, second family type of situation.
We should be having fun. This is a business that's meant to be that
Absolutely.
Way. It's a lot of hard work, but a lot of fun. One other point I want to make is that you have three other guys you work with. Obviously, Neil Bernardi, winemaker for Migration. You have Bill Nancaro over at Duckhorn itself. And, of course, David Marchese at Paradox. You have the opportunity to sort of compare notes. And I know they're doing something very different than you. Obviously, Neil's doing what you're doing. But, you know, do you get that opportunity often?
We do a lot. It's one of the great strengths of our company, which is the Duckhorn Wine Company and all these sort of waterfowl-based brands within our company. We have four tried true pedigreed winemakers who all have their own specialization, but ultimately we all love wine for the same reason. We all have bring our own experiences. So absolutely, when I have an issue or an interest or a problem, the first person I call is Bill Nancaro, you know, the winemaker at Duckhorn, and vice versa. We exchange ideas, and ultimately at the end of the process, we all it's mandated that we all taste all the winery's blends together. And so you bring all that winemaker power and then in order to assess and ultimately come up with the final blends for each brand, regardless of which brand you're principally, you know, overseeing.
I'd like to be in the room for that tasting.
You should come. We'll invite you.
Please do. I would take you up on that.
Yeah, no, the Paradox wines, I mean, all of the wines that in Duckhorn Wine Company, and even with our relatively new decoy line, our goal is, which is a lower price offering, but our goal is to still over-deliver at whatever, you know, price point that we're putting forth is to make the very best wine that we can, you know, regardless of price or appellation.
And prices out here, you know, a lot different from a lot of other valleys, and prices are very reasonable.
And it's true. I think that there's still, Anderson Valley still hasn't commercialized or embraced the true, you know, sort of commercialization of this business. And so a lot of the wineries here are still mom and pop wineries with, you know, the dog in the tasting room and, you know, and those type of things. So, and good wines come out of that. Good wines of character, you know, they're not sort of homogenous or broadly, you know, distributed.
I think that gives them a lot of personality. For my money as a wine lover, I kind of hope it stays that way, but I also hope a lot of people consider coming up this way.
No, I hope so too. You know, that part of the great strengths and great weaknesses of the Anderson Valley is that it is very remote. It is, it's an arduous path here, if you've seen the curvy roads, and there's really no beds in this town, right? So it's a thoroughfare to the Mendocino Coast, but if you are thinking about coming out here, make it all the way to the Mendocino Coast, which is a really dramatic piece of Pacific coastline here in Northern California.
From my own experience, having done it the other day, worth every minute of it, but I don't define the roads myself as arduous. I define them as being fun. One last thing, Zach, just for our listeners who'd like to find out more about you and more about your crew and about GoldenEye, how would they find out about you on the web?
Well, they should volunteer to work like you did for a couple days next harvest, but you can get us at www.goldeneyewinery.com.
You know, I had this opportunity, having only done this one other time, to come into a winery and work, and again, very hard work, I might add. You're saying that if somebody really did show a genuine interest, you'd welcome them in?
Yeah, absolutely. If you have an interest or you think that learning more about wine and wine production, and specifically Pinot Noir with our operation here in Anderson Valley, we would love to, you know, consider your application in the springtime prior to the coming vintage, you know, in April or May. Look us up at www.goldeneyewinery.com and contact me directly. We'd love to have some Midwesterners in our midst.
If they're smart, they would come out here because it's awfully nice out here. Zach, again, thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for the hospitality. This has been an absolute blast.
No problem. Love to have you.
Thanks.
We're done.
Thank you for listening to this program. And check us out on the web at lifebetweenthevines.com. You can learn more about GoldenEye and Migration Wines by going to goldeneyewinery.com or by visiting duckhornwineshop.com.